A week passed, and Hugh Lin was worse. One of the doctors said that an eye would have to be removed if his life were to be saved. The others agreed. They asked Edgar to tell the boy. When he did, Hugh Lin asked him to do a reading for him. An hour later, the reading was taken. The suggestion was given, and Edgar began to speak. He could see the body. The sight was not gone. The solution used by the doctors was helpful, but tannic acid should be added to it. The dressing should be changed frequently and applied constantly for 15 days, during which time the body was to be kept in a darkened room. After that, the eyes would be well. When Edgar awoke, the doctors told him that tannic acid was too strong for use on the eyes. However, they were sure that the sight was gone, so their objections were technical. They agreed to make the new solution and apply it. The days dragged by. On the 16th morning, after the reading, a white mass sloughed off with the bandages. Hugh Lin looked up at his father and spoke. "I can see!" A few weeks after Hugh Lin's recovery, Edgar developed symptoms of appendicitis. His doctor told him there was no reason to operate. An X-ray showed that the condition demanding surgery was not present. The symptoms remained, however, and on March 8th, the reading was taken. It advised an appendectomy within 24 hours. The doctor agreed to an operation, which was performed successfully. The diagnosis of the reading was found to be correct. The convalescents, Hugh Lin and Edgar, enjoyed the spring. Hugh Lin had developed into an excellent checker player. Edgar cheered and coached him during a series of matches, and in doing so, lost his voice. He got one of his friends to conduct a reading. Gertrude was away for the day. The conductor, in giving the suggestion, said the body of Edgar Casey would be found at 22½ Broad Street, which was the address of the building across the street. Edgar was unable to find the body. The conductor, surprised, asked him to describe the room. Edgar did so. The room described resembled the studio not at all. The conductor reached to the desk and looked at a piece of Edgar's stationery and saw his mistake. When the description of the room at 22½ was completed, he suggested that the body be sought at 21½. Edgar responded, "Yes, we have the body now. This we have had before. Now we will find..." When he awakened, the conductor told him what had happened and showed him the description of 22½, which he had taken down. The second floor had been specified. They could see its window from where they stood. They went downstairs, across the street, and entered 22½. Upstairs, in a room answering in every detail to the description Edgar had given, a bookkeeper was working. His appearance, even to the color of his suit, had been described without error. Ordinarily, readings were few and far between. Most of them were for friends or friends of friends, and there was seldom any remuneration. None was ever asked. Edgar was involved in his Sunday school class and his mission work. He enjoyed the letters he received from members of his old class in Hopkinsville. Many of them were serving as missionaries, and they described their activities for him. Often they asked for readings. The first readings for people in the foreign countries were given at the request of these former pupils. Edgar was pleased to find that he could locate an address in Mexico or England as easily as one in the United States. Eventually, all his friends in Selma heard about the readings, and many tried for themselves and members of their families. One of these cases was the talk of the town for a while. A sister of one of Edgar's Sunday school pupils went out of her mind suddenly. The reading said it was due to an impacted wisdom tooth. It suggested certain sedatives and advised removal of the tooth. An X-ray was taken, which revealed the impacted tooth. The tooth was removed, and after 8 days, the patient's mind returned to normal. Most of the people for whom check readings were regularly given had trouble of long standing. Their illnesses were complicated, and their readings outlined many treatments. There was always diet, and usually medicines, plus massage of some means or of stimulating areas where circulation was poor. Often osteopathic adjustments were advised. Sometimes patients were instructed to take medicines or adjustments in cycles on certain days of the week or at stated intervals. Edgar had no way of knowing how closely the treatments were followed, but he felt sure that many patients needed supervision. In any case, nothing was being proved about the readings. In the spring of 1915, Gertrude complained of symptoms of appendicitis. the day before she was to be operated on, a reading was taken. It said surgery was unnecessary and suggested that the capsules the doctor had prescribed be reinforced with 1/60th of a grain of another drug. After a week, the symptoms disappeared. Edgar was continually getting requests for readings from people who knew the Dietrichs. One of these came from a lumber merchant in Lexington, Kentucky, named Delaney. He wanted Edgar to give a reading for his wife, who had been ill for many years with a condition described as swelling arthritis. Her joints were so enlarged that she could not feed herself, and for 5 years had been unable to comb her hair. Mr. Delaney conducted the readings. A physician was present. When Edgar woke up, he asked Delaney what had been given. "Everything, including the kitchen sink. You have something for every square inch of her body, I think." 6 months later, Edgar returned and gave a check reading. Mrs. Delaney was slowly getting well. She was able to comb her hair. Later, a strange rash broke out all over her body. A check reading said an ingredient had been left out of her medicines, black sulfur. The lack of this had caused the rash. After another 6 months, Edgar returned. Mrs. Delaney could walk a little and had almost normal movement throughout the upper part of her body. The rash was gone. During the visit, Edgar was introduced to a neighboring family, the Kahns. He did a reading for one of the children. Mrs. Kahn was so grateful that she asked her eldest son, David, to promise that he would try to help Edgar with his work. Riding home on the train, Edgar puzzled on this. Back in Hopkinsville, several readings had been taken on the manner of conducting the business and making it known to the public. One of these had said that the work would succeed when a Jewish man became involved. Was David Kahn the one? Edgar still dreamed of finding a patron who would help him build a great hospital. Doctors would come there from all over the world to study the treatments and get readings on diseases in which they were specialists. Meanwhile, he was doing what work he could in the field before him. When the war came, it took many of his young friends to France, including David Kahn. Watching the members of his Sunday school class leave for training camp, he realized that he was getting older. He was now 40. When the war ended, the country was filled with restless energy as soldiers arrived home looking for jobs. Wouldn't this be the perfect time to try to do something about the readings? To make another attempt at starting a hospital? He was more of a family man now than ever. In February 1918, Gertrude gave birth to another son, Edgar Evans Casey. But Edgar's subconscious, it seemed, was growing more and more eager to be put to use. In March 1919, when he had not given a reading for several weeks, he went to sleep to give one evening, and 8 more tumbled out of him voluntarily. 7 of these were checkups, and the requests for them were in the mail. The 8th was for a new patient, and this request was also in the mail. When David Kahn returned from France, he wired Edgar to meet him at Lexington. He wanted to talk to Edgar about raising money to start a hospital. David exuded energy and enthusiasm. He suggested that they go to Texas to look at oil fields. That was how they could make the money. They would make millions, and they would run a hospital for free. They would make a scientific fact of psychic phenomena. They would produce medicines and medical truths that would benefit the whole world. But first, they had to go to Texas. When Hugh Lynn stepped off the train in Texas, his feet sank in mud up to his ankles. His father and David met him, wearing leather boots and rough clothes stained with mud. They bundled him into a car and roared off down a dirt track to Comin, which turned out to be a crossroads rather than a town. The oil well was in a field surrounded by mud. His mother had sent Hugh Lynn to Texas to find out why the oil wasn't coming in. It was now the summer of 1921. Other people were striking oil, yet despite Edgar's readings, the well at Comin remained dry. Edgar and Dave spent most of their time driving around the country getting leases on the surrounding land, so that when oil finally was struck, they would have a command of the whole region. When they were in Comin, they stayed in a group of shacks near the well. These were the property of the Ringles, a family of men who worked on the well and had an interest in the company. All of Edgar's readings were on the Comin well, and they were accurate. as far as predicting the stratum that would next be encountered in the drilling. It was on the strength of these predictions that the company's funds were being spent on leases. One thing about the reading struck Hugh Lynn as curious. He wrote to his mother about it. Each time the reading says that unless all the people are in accord about the purpose for which the money is to be used, nothing will come of it. I've been wondering if that could mean that the well won't come in. How could it keep the well from coming in if it's being drilled in the right place? He got his answer in a few days. Someone dropped a tool down the well, and operations had to be suspended while it was fished out. Old man Ringle posted himself and one of his sons at the well every night. But another accident occurred. The bit broke, and its parts had to be removed. Old man Ringle began to suspect David Kahn of sabotaging their efforts. A third accident occurred. This time a wedge was found in the hole. Ringle thought that David was trying to hold up the drilling so the local men would be frozen out when the leases expired, and David and some others could come in and snap them up. David offered to submit the whole thing to a reading. The conductor asked if it was true that Mr. Kahn was causing trouble at the well. Edgar responded, "We find that this is untrue. The interruptions are coming from outside sources. Now, as we have said in the past, unless those here are united in their purposes and are agreed that such monies as may be obtained from this enterprise are used for the good of all and to help their fellow men, there will be frustrations." Hugh Lynn wrote about it to his mother. "The men say they will build Dad as many hospitals as he wants when the well comes in. But I think the readings mean that they will have to give most of all the money to help people, not just part of it. Dad has been getting readings on the hospital. They say it must be built in Virginia Beach, Virginia, just like a reading said a long time ago. He is quite excited about the hospital, I think. He wishes he could come home, but he has to stay here until the well comes in." Another year passed, and nothing happened in Texas but more delays. Gertrude told Dr. House that she knew something was wrong. Drilling had been suspended on the well again and again, and feuds had broken out between members of the company. Dr. House decided to go to Texas to see if he could figure out what was going on. He wrote back to Gertrude that the trouble seemed to be coming from outsiders who didn't want the well to come in before the company's leases expired. By the end of the summer, this had happened. The leases ran out. The company's money ran out. And the well had still not come in. During the last month of operation, it was sabotaged methodically. The project was abandoned, and Dr. House returned to Hopkinsville. Edgar was packed and ready to go when he received a letter from Frank Moore, the man who had started to build a hospital in Nortonville in 1911. He had slowly gone blind, as a reading years before had predicted, as a possible result of an accident Moore had suffered at that time. The reading had advised hydrotherapy as a cure. In his letter to Edgar, he wrote, "I have taken 700 sweat baths, and my sight is restored." Moore again wanted to try to build a hospital. He had lost most of his money, but was sure money could be raised. He asked Edgar to visit him, and he did. The idea of a hospital had become an obsession with him. After meeting with Moore, Edgar traveled first to Denver and then to Birmingham, Alabama, to give readings and lectures. While he was in Birmingham, a group of people raised $60,000 for him to build a hospital in the area. But when a reading was taken to pinpoint the location, it suggested Virginia Beach, as before. The buildings committee had disbanded. After traveling to several other cities, Edgar returned to Selma, determined somehow to continue pursuing his goal. When Edgar returned to Selma after an absence of 4 years, his friends found him changed. He was both disillusioned about the possibility of finding anyone to help him further the readings, and more determined than ever to try to build something on them. The workroom of the studio was converted into an office for the business of the readings. Stationery was printed, and Edgar sent an announcement to everyone on his mailing list. After many attempts, he found a stenographer who could take down the technical language and involved sentence structure of the readings. One day a man named Arthur Lammers walked into the studio. He was a wealthy printer from Dayton, Ohio. He had come to get some readings, but not for sick people. He had other interests: philosophy, metaphysics, esoteric astrology, psychic phenomena. He was surprised to find that Edgar knew nothing about these subjects. "You ought to find out about these things. If there is any way of finding out, it's through you. The world is full of notions about its own beginning, its meaning, and its end. Which ones are true? What's the real nature of the soul? What's the purpose of our life here? Where do we go from here? Haven't you ever asked any of these questions?" Edgar had not. He had always considered such questions sacrilegious. Until now, he'd always believed that God was revealed only in the Bible. But listening to Lammer's talk, he began to wonder if God had given him this gift to learn from, as well as to heal himself and others. Lammers asked him to come to Dayton. "Philosophy and metaphysics have been my hobbies. They all agree on the one God, the need of morality, the brotherhood of the spirit, but beyond that is a sea of guesses. If these readings of yours are accurate, it means your subconscious mind can be reached. And if these occult and mystic theories are correct, the subconscious ought to be able to tell us as much about the world and ourselves as we want to know, or at least as much as we can understand." Edgar heard his own thoughts expressed in Lambert's words. He had returned to Selma convinced of his mission. Now he wanted to know why he had a mission and how it was to be fulfilled. He wanted to find out everything he could by way of the readings. At last he could join them together, at least in his mind, the two conflicting forces of his life, the Bible and the readings. He agreed to go to Dayton. Lammers arranged to bring a secretary and a stenographer to the readings. Before the first one, he told Edgar that he was going to ask him about astrology. When Edgar woke up, Lammers spoke to him gravely. "There is something wrong with our notion of astrology, apparently. We leave out a factor that's very important: reincarnation." Edgar stared at him. Lammers went on. "You say I've lived before on this earth. You say this is my third appearance in this sphere, and that I will still have some of the inclinations of my last life when I was a monk. You also say that the solar system is a cycle of experiences for the soul. It has 8 dimensions corresponding to the planets. This is the third dimension. And it is sort of a laboratory for the whole system, because only here is free will completely dominant. On the other planes or dimensions, some measure of control is kept over the soul to see that it learns the proper lessons. The control is usually by the soul itself, if it is evolved sufficiently. The subconscious is a record of all the lives of the soul. It's a story of what we do with our spirit, the portion of God that is given to us for life. With the gift of individuality, or separate existence from God, our task is to perfect our individuality, and then return to God." Edgar shook his head. "I said all that?" "Oh, there's more. Our astrological influence from the dimensions we have inhabited will be good or bad according to the experiences we had there. The stars represent soul patterns, not experiences. The 12 signs of the zodiac are 12 patterns from which the soul chooses when coming into the earth plane." Edgar interrupted him. "I couldn't have said all that in one reading." Lammers agreed. "No, but you confirmed it. The important thing is that the basic system that runs through all the mystery religions, whether they come from Tibet or Egypt, is backed up by you. It's the right system. It's hermetic. It's Pythagorean. It's Jewish. It's Christian. Jesus said he came to fulfill the law, not abolish it. The Mosaic law had to do with the external acts. It did not consider internal morality. The mission of Christ was to reveal the law of inner morality to all people, and then to give them an example in himself of the fulfillment of that pattern. Somehow, somewhere, each of us must reach the perfection of Christ. Then we can return to God and be one with Him. Edgar's head was whirling. He and Lammers left to have something to eat. During the meal, Lammers continued his explanations. He spoke of the medieval Rosicrucians, the oracles of Nostradamus, the Aeneids of Plotinus, the mysteries of Eleusis, Bacchus, Mithras, and Osiris. He mentioned a procession of the equinoxes and its connection with the worship of the bull and the ram. Finally, Edgar stopped him. "I haven't the slightest idea what you're talking about. What I want to know is all this stuff you've been telling me in agreement with Christianity? Or is it pagan?" Lammers settled back in his chair. "Not only does it agree with the best ethics of religion and society, it's the source of them. Reincarnation is the ancient wisdom that inspired them and gave them to the world with a simple explanation that most people could understand. Christ, or God, who sent him, believed that people were ready for a higher form of morality than the one they had been following. It was the next step in the revelation of the truth. This particular truth has been in existence, and known to a minority of people, ever since man has been on earth. He brought it with him, and such phenomena as clairvoyance have always been available to correct the mistakes that occur from generation to generation as the wisdom is handed down in writing and by word of mouth. What I don't know is just how much of it Christ taught to his disciples. I've often suspected it's all in the latter part of the Gospel of St. John. At any rate, after Christianity began to rise in power in the Roman Empire, its leaders decided to change it from an idealistic philosophy appealing to intellectuals to a practical religion for the common man. Edgar was still worried. "Well, if the leaders of the church thought it best to keep these things secret, why should we expose them?" Lammers hesitated before speaking. "I don't know. Maybe it was meant to be exposed 1900 years ago. It always seems to have been available to those who sought it." They returned to the room for the afternoon reading. When Edgar woke up, Lammers was nodding his head. "Just as I thought, only better. The conscious mind is the record of this life. The thoughts go from the conscious to the imaginative, introspective mind. Then they pass on to the subconscious or soul mind, which is seated with its spirit just above the heart. The subconscious mind is therefore the storehouse of all our experiences and thought, for all our lives here and elsewhere. To the degree that these experiences have been in the right direction, a man is cultured and humane. Nothing is forgotten by the subconscious. Therefore, if you, in one or more of your past lives, learned this wisdom, it is not surprising that you still possess it. The fact that your subconscious mind is articulate is the strange thing. Tomorrow we'll take a reading and ask why you were given this power, and for what purpose. For what purpose it's to be used." Edgar agreed. "Yes, I want to know that. But what you've been telling me today, and what the readings have been saying, is foreign to all I've ever believed and been taught in my whole life." Lammers laughed and stood up. "I know how you feel. I remember how upset I was when I first heard of reincarnation. Then I began applying it to what I knew and what I observed about people, and soon I realized that psychology and psychoanalysis were developed to provide the explanation of life that are inherent in the doctrine of reincarnation." Lammers put on his coat. Edgar had one more question. "Why can't we remember our former lives?" "Because we'd never learn anything if we did. We'd carry over all our weaknesses and our strengths, our likes and our dislikes. That would make a mess of our free will. What we have been creates our character. Then, with the agent of free will, we go forth into a world that's like a laboratory test." He shook hands with Edgar. "I'll leave you now. You have a lot to think over." After he had gone, Edgar remained seated on the couch. After a while, he found his Bible and opened it to the New Testament. He knew the Gospels well. In none of them was there a condemnation of astrology or reincarnation. There was, in fact, no mention of reincarnation at all. Why? Astrology was different. People had believed in the stars in biblical times, and there might, by simple reasoning, be something in it. Everyone knew the influence of the sun on the earth, and the sun was a star. The moon, too, of course, affected the earth, creating the tides. The stars were far beyond the moon and the planets, but their light came to the earth. Might it not influence in some way the brain or the emotions? Lammers had said it was all a pattern. The body was an objectification of the soul, and this life was but one of many spent here and out in the far-flung worlds that stretch to the horizons of the cosmos. Edgar shook his head. It all sounded like nonsense. After sitting for a long time, he went outside and walked until he came to a river. It was dark now. Stood there thinking of Saul and of Augustine. Both of them had started by disbelieving in things as they were, then discovering something new. Both were scoffed at. Was a call coming to him now, as it had come to these two men? Was this an opportunity to serve, the opportunity that he had so long been seeking? If he refused to help Lammers further with his investigations, he might never know the real purpose of his gift. And if he decided to go on the path they had begun that day, he stood the chance of alienating his friends and his family. Or was it possible that they might be willing to follow him on this new path? He walked back to his hotel and sat down to write a letter to Gertrude. So much has happened in the last few days, and I cannot begin to tell you about it. The important thing is that I am remaining here to organize the work of the readings with Mr. Lammers. He will back it. I want you and the boys to join me as soon as you can. When the letter was finished, he sat by the window, remembering another October morning. He picked up his Bible and turned to the 46th Psalm. God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore we will not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God. As the train approached Dayton, Hugh Len looked more and more apprehensively at the barren fields he was passing. A month before, his mother and brother had come forth to join his father. He had stayed in Selma to finish the school term. Now he was going to Dayton for Christmas, without any idea of what he would find there. His family met him at the station and bundled him off to a streetcar. The apartment was upstairs, in a not-too-fashionable neighborhood. His father explained that Mr. Lammers, who had planned to back him, was having legal problems and had tied up all his money. Hugh Len asked his father if they were coming back to Selma. Edgar shook his head. There are things that make it impossible to go back. I've got to stick to this work now, no matter what happens. Lammers has done a lot for me. He has opened my eyes to many things. After a scanty meal, his father and mother began to tell him about the new type of reading Edgar was giving. It was called a life reading, and it had to do with reincarnation. Hugh Len was alarmed. You never told me anything about that in Sunday school. Is it true? Edgar looked him in the eyes. I don't know whether I believe it or not. The readings say it's true. We asked a lot of questions. We asked why reincarnation wasn't in Christianity. The answer was that it used to be in the early days. There was a sect of Christians called the Gnostics. The readings say they kept the line unbroken between old religions and the new one. We know that Christ didn't intend to form a new religion. He meant to reform the Jewish religion, one of the old religions worshiping one God. Just like the other old religions or mystery religions, the Jewish faith had a secret doctrine. It was called Kabbalah. The students who learned it were called initiates, and those were the high priests. They learned the esoteric part of the religion, and the people were given the same fundamental philosophy and the same moral code, but with a simple explanation. When the leaders of the early church decided to propagate the faith to all people, they dropped the doctrine of reincarnation. It was difficult to explain. It made life more complex, and it made virtue even more necessary. So the early Christian fathers and their explanation of Christianity triumphed over the Gnostics and their more accurate version. What they did was right, I suppose, because without simplification of the faith, it would never have spread. It would have remained a small sect for intellectuals and students of metaphysics. But the readings say that no sect should ever be allowed to form around the work we are doing now. They say we are merely to present what we have to those who seek it. Hugh Lin was still confused. I don't understand reincarnation. His father nodded in agreement. I don't either. But there are a lot of things we believe in but don't understand. Relativity, for example, and atoms. But some people do understand reincarnation. The Hindus, for example. They understand it. Edgar got up and went for his Bible. I believe Jesus taught it, too. Jesus says that unless a man is perfect, he cannot enter the kingdom. Well, what man, when he dies, is perfect? Once in a while, a man dies who is good enough to go to heaven, but not often. So isn't it logical that we have to be born again and keep trying? There is no doubt about what Jesus taught. Only a perfect soul can enter heaven. But the theory of reincarnation was too complex for most people, so Jesus himself became the example of the perfect life. But Christianity has changed. Today, no one tries to be like Jesus or thinks that it's necessary to live like Jesus in order to get to heaven. In spite of himself, Hugh Lin was interested in his father's new ideas. He was curious about the life readings and wanted to know about them. They showed him their readings and some others and described some of the incarnations. No matter how far back the incarnations reached, they shared one characteristic. All seemed concerned with the same basic problems of soul development. It was the task of working out these basic problems that concerned the present personality. All that had been done about them previously was active in the personality of the person in his current incarnation. They showed him Edgar's life reading, which explained his psychic power. Two things were responsible for it. He had once attained a great height in soul development, only to slip downward through a series of lives. The present life was a chance to atone for some of his past mistakes. It was a crucial life. He had purposely been given a great temptation, balanced by an equal opportunity for good. Hugh Lin asked to see his own life reading, but after he had read it, he said he didn't recognize any of his incarnations. None of these people are like me, Edgar smiled. They weren't like you, but you're not the same person that you were a few days ago or a few hours ago. You're not the same person you were when you sat down at this table. Every time a thought goes through your head, it changes you. Your conscious mind compares every new experience and thought with all the related experiences and thoughts you've ever had in your life. Your subconscious mind, the soul's mind, compares every new experience and thought with every related experience and thought you've had in all your lives, and then with truth itself. At each stage, you form a judgment on the experience and thought. Then you adopt an attitude about the experience. Thus, all your past experiences and thoughts affect how you view what happens to you in this life, and of course, everything you do and think in this life affects all your future lives. Hugh Lynn remained skeptical. To him, it all smacked of occultism. Yet the reasonableness of the theory began to work on him, and he found that gradually it was changing the way he looked at life. Through a friend of Lammer's, Hugh Lynn and his brother Edgar Evans were sent to excellent schools. But money for food and clothing for the family was scarce. Several other men whom Edgar had helped through his readings contributed to the family from time to time. Others became interested in Edgar's work, and tentative plans were made to form an association and erect a hospital. But readings taken on the subject insisted that Virginia Beach was still the place to build. It was best for Edgar Casey to live near a large body of water. The readings explained this. It was best for psychic work to be carried on near water. It was best that people coming for readings travel over water to get them. All in all, Virginia Beach was the ideal spot for any plans to be formed around the work. They could best be accomplished there. This insistence on Virginia Beach threw a damper on the idea of psychic society. The group gradually broke up, leaving only a few individuals still interested in Edgar's work. One of these was Morton Blumenthal, a New York stockbroker, who was in partnership with his brother Edwin. He had heard of Edgar through David Kahn. Blumenthal had been troubled with a running ear. Following a series of treatments, the ear improved. Then Blumenthal got a series of life readings. A boyhood interest in philosophy was reawakened. He began to get readings of all kinds of metaphysical and theological questions. Blumenthal was making money on the rising stock market. When he heard that the readings specified Virginia Beach as the location for a hospital and a psychic society, he urged Edgar to go there and told him that he would provide the money. Edgar wondered what calamity would overtake Blumenthal's finances now that he had decided to back the readings. Everyone who had undertaken the task had gone broke. Was Blumenthal the right one? Was he the Jew the readings had foretold? A series of readings were held on the proposed organization. Gertrude was now conducting all the readings, and the results were better and more uniform. The readings agreed that she would be a good conductor, and suggested that for life readings, Edgar changed the position of his body by lying with his head to the north rather than the south. This would prevent the dizzy spells he sometimes experienced after a life reading. The readings also insisted that no organization could ever do the slightest good unless there was a proper spirit among the members of the organization and its leaders. When Edgar explained this to Blumenthal, he said that he understood. "Don't worry. This time it will work. When can you move to the beach? I've secured a house for you there. If you like it, I'll buy it for you. And you'd better hurry if you want to get in for the season. August is nearly over." They stepped off the bus into a howling storm. Their new home was a summer residence built on a sandhill. Practically all the houses around it were boarded up. The season was over. After they were settled, they spent their evenings by the fireplace, which was the only source of heat. The subject of their conversations was always the same. Why had the readings sent them to Virginia Beach? Most of the readings they held there were for Blumenthal. He got them on every subject. He sent long letters describing his reactions to the answers given to his questions and asked questions on these reactions. He took courses in philosophy at night, and the problems raised by his studies were presented in the readings. Blumenthal worked hard to build his philosophy into a complete system, but the problems he sought to solve were difficult. Sometimes the questions were answered, but he did not understand the answers. Sometimes he was told that the answer was beyond human comprehension. Often he was told that unless he incorporated the truths he was discovering into his life, they would do him more harm than good. It was a bleak winter. They had no neighbors and knew no one else in town. There was little to do except conduct readings for Blumenthal. But spring came early. Blumenthal had paid promptly for each of his readings, and there was money in the bank. Hugh Lynn was told he could go to college in the fall. The Casey family found that summer was heavenly at the beach. The houses that had been empty all winter filled with people. The population of the town increased from 3,000 to 30,000. Hugh Lin left for Washington and Lee University in mid-September. In October, Edgar's mother became very ill. The reading said she could not live. Edgar went to Hopkinsville and gave another reading. The result was the same. The soul is about to take flight. Do not grieve. She died on the evening of the 26th. With Edgar sitting beside her, she was conscious and aware to the last, talking to him and smiling. It's hard to go, but I know your prayers have been answered. Down there at the beach, I know you will stay there and succeed. On May 6, 1927, the Association of National Investigators was incorporated in the state of Virginia. Its purpose was to engage in general psychic research, and its primary goal was education. A hospital was to be built and the readings scientifically studied. Blumenthal was president of the association. The bylaws provided that any person requesting a reading had first to become a member of the association, agreeing that he was participating in an experiment in psychic research. This protected Edgar and the association from legal prosecution. Members were to have access to the facilities of the association, its hospital, library, records, research data, and so on. All the readings were to be considered the property of the person for whom they were taken, but copies were to be kept by the association and extracts could be made by students, providing the identity of the owner was withheld. The life readings were to be especially guarded, as they were considered more personal and revealing than physical diagnosis. Edgar was becoming acutely aware that if it were true that the early church had dropped reincarnation as a dangerous and impractical truth, the decision had been a wise one. People almost invariably got the wrong idea about their life readings. Edgar tried to explain to them that the life reading was a balance sheet, and if the asset once possessed was missing, it was something to be alarmed about. But people tended to be complacent about their current unremarkable lives if they learned that they had been rich or powerful or physically beautiful in a past life. Edgar attempted to tell them that most souls possessed greater virtue in their earlier lives simply because of the virtue of innocence. The path of the soul was downward until free will made the turn upward. So there was no reason whatsoever to feel proud of a life lived 10 or 15,000 years ago. Only when goodness and intelligence were attained in the present by the use of free will would a measure of satisfaction be permissible. Edgar came to sympathize deeply with the early church fathers who had split off from the Gnostics. In 1927, the squire came to live with his son, and Tommy House, Carrie's son, moved in and enrolled in the local high school. Both Blumenthal and David Kahn came to the beach frequently. Blumenthal, who was still profiting from the stock market, had decided to buy land for the hospital as well as a university. One afternoon in 1928, a man drove up to the house and introduced himself as Dr. William Brown, head of the psychology department at Washington and Lee University. He shook hands with Edgar and smiled. "Hugh Lin is one of my students. I made a statement that I could expose any medium, and he asked me to come down here and expose his father." Dr. Brown settled down to ask questions. He examined readings, listened to several, and finally admitted that he was stumped. "I can't expose it, but I also can't ignore it. I guess I'll have to believe in it." He joined the association, had a reading for himself, and got others of his family to do so. Edgar wagged his head in wonder. The millennium has come. It was a spring day when they broke ground for the hospital. Edgar felt both fulfilled and frightened. Here was all he had ever dreamed or desired. Yet it rested for security on the whim of a single man, Morton Blumenthal. So many others had tried and failed. Would Blumenthal succeed? Oh, he hoped so. For once the hospital was operating, others would surely come, and an endowment fund that would make it independent of Blumenthal could be raised. Then Blumenthal could devote himself to the university, which was becoming more and more his main interest. Dr. House and Carrie were now at the beach. Dr. House had resigned his post in Hopkinsville and was ready to take charge of the hospital. Curry was to be its matron. Construction proceeded rapidly. By November, the building was finished and ready for occupancy. The cost was in the neighborhood of $200,000. Blumenthal had asked for the best of materials. It was a 30-bed hospital and was designed to be a home for the patients. Temporarily, it was also to be a center for the association's other activities. There was a lecture hall and a library, a vault for housing the readings, and offices for research workers. Dedication ceremonies were held on November 11th. The crowd filled the living room and overflowed to the library and lecture hall. Blumenthal, smiling and happy, turned the building over to the association. Edgar, hardly knowing what he said, accepted it. The first patient was admitted the next day. He had a chronic sinus condition, and his blood showed diabetic tendencies. His readings suggested baths, packs, osteopathy, medicine, and diet. The treatments were carried out. In 2 weeks, a check reading discharged him as sufficiently well to go back to work, providing he continued some of the treatments at home. To Edgar, there was a real joy in seeing all the treatments suggested by a reading carried out, with cooperation between the people administering them and attempt to harmonize their effects on the patient. Over the years, certain ideas about health, the causes of disease, and cures had been repeated over and over again in readings. There was a compound given for every person suffering for pyrrhea, an inhalant suggested for one of three types of hay fever, castor oil packs for appendicitis and intestinal complication, grape poultices for intestinal fevers, a compound that time and time again had proved helpful in treating the common cold. At the hospital, these and other remedies could be checked and rechecked until their value was beyond doubt. Then they could be turned over to the medical profession and the public. Two general types of appliance had for many years been prescribed in readings. One, the radioactive, was connected so that the electrical current of the body passed through the appliance, which acted as a transformer, sending the current back at a regular rate of impulse. In cases where the circulation was impaired, this meant a speeding up. Where the circulation was too rapid, it meant a slowing down. The other type, the wet cell, operated on the theory that a very low electrical charge set up in an ordinary wet solution of acid, metal, copper sulfate, can be discharged through a solution of gold chloride, camphor, iodine, and others, and the vibratory impulse can be carried to the body, causing it to extract more of the particular property in the solution from its digested foods. These appliances, now properly built and maintained, were in the hospital, along with cabinets where sweat baths could be had. There were also all the regular equipment of a hospital, of course. Dr. House, being both a medical doctor and an osteopath, supervised the allopathic treatments and administered the mechanical adjustments. Carrie had charge of the kitchen and dining room. The nurses learned to give the massages prescribed for certain patients and took others to the beach for sand packs. The reading said the sand at Virginia Beach had a large gold content and was highly radioactive. When summer came, the boys were put to work. Hugh Lynn and Tommy took over the job of acquainting newcomers and visitors with the history and theory of the readings. Tommy's brother, Gray, took over the manufacture of the radioactive appliances and the maintenance of the electrical machines. Work was begun on several medicines that, though the procedures were clearly outlined in readings, were difficult to produce. Two of these were carbon ash and animated ash. In each case, the ash had to be that of the wood of a bamboo tree, burned with the flame of a carbon lamp, and treated in a vacuum. These were to be taken internally for such things as tuberculosis. The readings had always been as democratic in the selection of medicines as they were in the selection of treatments. No drug manufacturer was shown the slightest favor. Often the readings suggested uses for the drugs that were not listed by the manufacturer. In one instance, they helped the chemist perfect his formula and then put it to a use that had not entered the inventor's head. The readings prescribe medicines in cycles, 10 days, then a 3-day rest, for example. Or they might specify that a certain patient take a medicine only on certain days of the week. There was apparently no elaborate medical system or theory to be got from the cures. Glandular conditions were the basic causes for many disturbances. Childhood bumps and bruises often caused lesions that brought on obscure ailments. Karmic conditions predisposed a body to a certain trouble or gave it a weakness. Once diagnosed, an affliction was attacked at its source. No cure could come except through the natural channel, assimilation of needed properties through the digestive system from food taken into the body. An affliction or disturbance upset the natural equilibrium of this process. Certain necessary properties for the maintenance of the body were not extracted from digested food. The proper equilibrium of the assimilating system had to be restored. All the treatments were aimed at this accomplishment. That, if anything, was the medical philosophy of the readings. All schools and types of treatments were employed as necessary to help the patient. But there was a difference between the aim of the readings and the aim of the average doctor. The doctor aimed at curing a specific ailment. The readings aimed at producing a healthy body, which would itself get rid of the ailment. In one case, the evidence of the ailment was removed. In another case, its cause was eliminated. In cases of chronic disturbance, the reading outlined systems of treatment far more complex and detailed than a doctor could devise. And the treatments lasted longer, sometimes for years, than the average physician would consider necessary for recovery from the same ailment. Day after day, new patients appeared for readings, and old ones had their condition checked and rechecked. The mail brought more and more requests. The calendar was crowded for weeks and months ahead. But only a small portion of the total readings given were for patients in the hospital, though most of its beds were filled all the time. Blumenthal was already looking for a new field to conquer. The hospital was a fulfillment for Edgar, but Blumenthal dreamed of founding a university. He began by buying up land opposite the hospital, on the other side of the boulevard, between it and the ocean. Here he planned to establish Atlantic University. It was to be a modest project at first, until a staff of teachers was gathered that could integrate the new philosophy with the old, orthodox system of education. He decided to erect 2 buildings as a nucleus. What he needed first was a man to take charge of the undertaking. Dr. Brown agreed to do so. Meanwhile, on October 12th, Dr. House died. He had been sick a long, long time, following a serious illness and years of overwork at the hospital in Hopkinsville. The readings had outlined treatments that kept him active, but offered no hope for anything but alleviation, since his entire system was affected. The hospital experimented with several osteopaths during the fall. It was impossible at that time to find a man with both a medical degree and osteopathic training. Ordinary medical doctors were out of the question. They either laughed at the readings or condemned them as quackery. In January 1930, Dr. Lyman Leidick of Dayton, Ohio, was induced to abandon his practice and take charge of the hospital. He was an osteopath who had become interested in the readings and had worked with them while Edgar was in Dayton. Annie Casey, Edgar's sister, took Carrie's place as housekeeper at the hospital. Headway was being made by the statistician on the job of setting up a system of cross-indexing the readings and extracting information from them on various subjects and specific ailments. In the spring, Dr. Brown moved to the beach, and plans for the university crystallized. It was open in the fall without waiting for the erection of the buildings. The association announced that the university would be a supplement to the hospital, a parallel service for the mind and spirit. Actually, there was to be no connection between the association and the university. Dr. Brown's theory was that the scholastic respectability should first be won, after which the subject of psychic phenomena could be taken up in a proper, respectable manner. The university, in fact, was to dwarf the association and its hospital. It was to be a modern institution of higher learning, with a faculty second to none and a complete, elaborate curriculum, especially in the arts. This was not Blumenthal's original intention. The association needed a small school where philosophy, metaphysics, psychic phenomena, psychology, and occultism could be studied in an intelligent manner, with facilities for the proper research and laboratory experiments. No such program was in Dr. Brown's outline. He wanted a university like other universities, only a little better. Apparently, he had convinced Blumenthal that this was the correct approach to take. Edgar looked askance at the whole project. If a university were to grow from the work, it should do so as a logical outgrowth of the research program, not as an institution superimposed on the structure of the association and dwarfing it. According to Dr. Brown's plan, it was to be just another college, no different from the hundreds of other colleges already existing in the country. The idea of a small group of students applying themselves to a study of the readings and then gradually gathering around them students interested in metaphysics and philosophy was lost in the grandiose scheme of a big-time school with a high-class faculty and a big football team. Edgar was not so worried about the development of the university itself as he was concerned with the effect on the hospital. Already checks from Blumenthal were arriving late. He was beginning to make remarks about the economy and the need for lowering the hospital's budget. Of course, the country was in the midst of the Depression, but Blumenthal had always said that the stock market crash the preceding October had not affected him. A new building was finished in the hospital grounds that summer, a home for the nurses. Across the boulevard, foundations were laid for the university buildings. The school was to open on September 22nd. In two of the oceanfront hotels that would close after Labor Day. These would serve as dormitories. Classes were to be held in office buildings all over the beach, and assemblies would take place in the Presbyterian Church. Hugh Lynn opened a temporary library on the ground floor of the boys' dormitory. As opening day approached, there were 200 students enrolled, a remarkable beginning. Meanwhile, members of the board of directors of the hospital received notice of a meeting to be held on September 16th. Edgar, Gertrude, the squire, and Hugh Lynn attended, prepared for the worst. When the meeting was called to order, Blumenthal began to speak. He sketched the history of the hospital's finances. When it had opened, it had cost him $3,000 a month. Gradually, this had been cut down by the income from patients. During 1 month, the income from patients had matched the overhead. Now, however, the hospital owed nearly $10,000 for items of overhead. Obviously, there had been waste and extravagance. Though it was a place of healing, it ought to be run on a more businesslike basis. Therefore, it was his suggestion that the association turn the hospital back to him and his brother Edwin, with the understanding that the bills would be paid and everything kept running as usual. Would the board vote on this suggestion? A vote was taken. The members, stunned by the proposal, automatically voted against it. It was defeated. Blumenthal was irritated. He mentioned the possibility of withdrawing all funds and forcing the hospital to close. Another vote was suggested. Edgar got up to speak. I have every confidence in Mr. Blumenthal. He built the hospital. He has maintained it. He understands the work I do better than almost anyone else. I'm sure he is desirous of continuing the efforts we have all begun. It would mean very little to me to have the hospital without his cooperation and interest. I suggest the board accede to his request. Another vote was taken. The proposal won, and the meeting was adjourned. All the members except Blumenthal and his brother came to Edgar's house to ask him what happened, but Edgar didn't really know. He had been aware from the beginning that the hospital and association were heavy structures to rest on the foundation of one man's whim. Blumenthal had not possessed the money to endow the hospital. He had paid for it out of his winnings in the market, and as these went, so went everything he had built at the beach. The hospital, with its income from patients, might have got by with what help he could offer. The university was apparently taking all his money at this point. Unless the readings themselves were responsible. Physical readings had so crowded the calendar that Blumenthal's requests for philosophical guidance had been postponed time and time again. He had grown used to this help and seemed at a loss without it. When even his Sunday readings had been replaced by emergency physical readings, he was cut off from a source of mental food that had become necessary to him. He had become fascinated by the subconscious and was attempting to fathom its language by having his dreams interpreted. He was also delving deeper and deeper into the metaphysical structure of the universe. To be stopped in all this must have irritated and alienated him. One thing was certain. The readings had repeatedly told Blumenthal that the knowledge of philosophical truths meant nothing in itself. The truths had to become part of his life to mean anything. He had ignored this. He had learned a lot, and he had done something about it in an external way, but there had apparently been little change within himself. When he couldn't get what he wanted for himself from the readings, he didn't care about helping others to get what they needed. Edgar tried to believe that things would be all right, that the stock market would swing upward, but the depression only deepened. Atlantic University opened. For the first semester, Blumenthal met all the bills. Then he ceased his support. The hospital continued to run. The outstanding bills were paid. The staff was cut. The budget reduced. After January, Dr. Brown had to try to keep the university going by his own efforts. In February 1931, a meeting of the Board of Trustees of the Association was held in New York in the offices of Blumenthal Brothers. Hugh Lynn and Edgar drove up from the beach to attend it. Blumenthal moved that all activities of the Association cease. The motion was declared carried, though there wasn't a quorum. Patients at the hospital had already been notified that they would have to leave. The staff was paid off and the doors closed. The first thing Edgar did was to arrange to have the files of the readings removed from the basement and placed in his house. Then he wandered through the rooms, looking through the windows to the sea. Finally, he walked out of the empty hospital. His feelings were mixed. In 2 years, the hospital had demonstrated its worth. In the office was a list of patients asking for entrance. Those who had received treatment had been helped or cured. The files bulged with affidavits and letters of thanks. A tragedy it might be, conceived in impracticality, executed in haste, abandoned in its hour of victory, but despite everything, it had not been a mistake. Edgar called a meeting at his home on the afternoon of June 6, 1931. 61 people attended, overflowing to the porch and up the stairs. David Kahn was present, and Dr. Brown, whose university had staggered to the end of its first year. Edgar opened the meeting and explained its purpose. Last winter, when the hospital closed and the association was dissolved, I sent a letter to everyone on my mailing list. In it, I asked a question, whether, in your opinion, another organization should be formed. I received hundreds of replies. They all said the same thing. They urged me to continue the work, to form a new organization, to carry on the program that was begun and abandoned. This is why this meeting was called. I can go on giving readings for those who ask them. I will do that anyhow. I always will, no matter what happens. But if the readings are ever to be anything else, if they're ever to mean anything to groups and masses of people, if they are ever to add one bit, however small, to the goodness of the world or its wisdom, it is up to you and all the others who believe in them. I'm ready to do my part. I'll do it as well as I can. He sat down. Others spoke, including David Kahn, telling of their interest in the work and the results they had obtained from readings. Dr. Brown suggested a name for the new organization. The Association for Research and Enlightenment. The title was adopted, and officers were elected. The meeting adjourned. Afterward, everyone assured Edgar that it wouldn't be long before either the hospital was reopened or a new one built. In July, the new association was incorporated, with the same specified purpose as its predecessor. In the same month, Edgar legally returned his home to Blumenthal. Atlantic University was meanwhile conducting a summer session in a high school a few miles from the beach. But there was no money to pay the professors, and there was no money for the new association either. In October, Edgar and Gertrude went to New York to talk things over with their friends there. The consensus was that a new building or funds to purchase the old building would have to wait, years perhaps, until the country recovered from the Depression. Edgar shuddered inwardly. He was 54. Could he live to see a new hospital established? On November 7th, the family was packed and ready to leave New York for the beach. Two women residents of the hotel had been trying for a week to get a reading. Edgar had not had time. The women had been given an application blank and told to fill it out and send it to the association's office at the beach. Early in the afternoon, an association member who had a reading appointment canceled it. The women were informed that they could have a reading at that time if they still wanted it. They came to the suite, the reading was given, and the Caseys were arrested for fortune-telling. The two women were police women. For Edgar, it seemed like the end of the world. The road on which he had started with Lane 31 years before had come to the destination he had always been afraid it might reach. From the beginning, the case was thin. The police women had no warrant, they had not been solicited for the reading, and one of them had signed an application blank. She was thus a member of the association when the reading was given. The blank had disappeared. Even so, there was little evidence to support the fortune-telling charge. Local members of the association rallied to their support, and a brilliant young attorney was hired to represent them. David Kahn, as a trustee, testified that the association was a philanthropic, non-profit organization that was formed to study the readings and that employed Edgar to work for it. Edgar testified that all money received for readings was paid to the association. After questioning Edgar, who explained why and how the association had been formed, the judge ruled that Edgar had not been pretending to tell fortunes, and the case was dismissed. Edgar and Gertrude returned to Virginia with great relief. Back at the beach, the family held a meeting. Edgar was beginning to wonder where the next blow would strike. He felt hunted. He didn't understand Blumenthal's loss of interest in the hospital. He was still shaken by his arrest. Was it another test? Or had he somehow offended God? What should he do now? Hugh Lynn had a suggestion. Maybe there's something wrong with us. In the first place, we don't really know what we're doing. We don't know anything about psychic phenomena. We have our own experiences. We don't know what else has been done in the field. What do we know about life readings? Do we know enough about philosophy or metaphysics and comparative religion to check the readings? When a statement about anatomy or about a disease or about the use of a medicine or herb is made, do we know what medical authorities have said about the same thing? I think we should stop dreaming of another hospital and concentrate on what we already have. I'll take over as manager of the association. We'll keep it small. We'll have a modest budget and a modest program. We'll work quietly by ourselves with the help of local people who are interested. We'll start study groups. We'll take a series of readings on various subjects. We'll build up a library on psychic phenomena. Edgar had a sense of great relief. It's all yours. You take it over. I'll just give the readings. The program was begun right away. Soon afterward, Hugh Lynn came home waving a book on hypnotism. I've been reading about Mesmer's experiments. Mesmer didn't actually hypnotize his subjects, you know. Hypnotism was discovered by a follower of Mesmer, the Marquis de Puysegur. He discovered it accidentally in 1784 when he was trying Mesmer's magnetizing procedure on a young shepherd named Victor. Victor went into a sleeping trance and remained in it for some time. De Puysegur then found that the boy was apparently clairvoyant. He seemed able to diagnose the physical ailments of other people while in this trance. A whole fad was started, and people began to go to somnambulists instead of doctors. The fad finally died out after the 1820s. Do you realize what this means? The first person ever hypnotized showed the same ability that you have. Hugh Lynn went on explaining. Hypnotism hasn't advanced any since then. It's always been investigated or damned and exploited. Apparently, somebody missed the boat over 100 years ago. The kind of thing you do was abandoned, and it's been lost ever since. But we've got the records to show that it really works. Edgar was dubious. Well, maybe. Records don't mean much to people who don't want to believe what the records say. Hugh Lynn looked at the book in his hand. Say, I wonder where this Victor is now. If he's on Earth, he'd be useful. We could use him as your assistant. His father smiled. He remembered his son did not believe in reincarnation. At Christmas, Atlantic University closed its doors. Hugh Lynn, freed from his duties as librarian, decided to start a monthly bulletin as a means of keeping in touch with the members of the association. A study group was formed in Norfolk to meet once a week. It chose for its subject, How to Develop Psychic Powers. But the first reading pointed out that psychic powers are attributes of the soul, and in the normal development of an individuality, blossoms as a result of the ascending consciousness. The reading pointed out that there was little to be gained by a series of dissertations on soul development if nothing was done actively by the group. It suggested that the group create a series of lessons, which they could check by taking readings. When the group attempted to write its first lesson on prayer, they found that they would need a great deal of patience and perseverance to complete the task that had been set for them. It took months and months of labor before their statements could be verified through the readings. One of the lessons, on spirit, took more than a year. In May of that year, the Casey family moved to a house on a small lake near the sea. It was here, in June 1932, that the first annual Congress of the Association was held. The Congress was the result of the success of the bulletin. During the year, Hugh Lynn had been able to clear the mailing list of all but some 300 members who were genuinely interested in the work and in psychic phenomena. The Congress was fertile soil for the study group idea. Members went away with copies of the first lessons and organized groups in their towns and cities to study them. Hugh Lynn's program expanded during the second year. He published some case studies, detailed reports of illnesses, including excerpts from the readings, letters from patients, and statements from those administering the treatments. He also published papers on reincarnation, sources of psychic phenomena, and historical periods as described in the life readings. A study group of local people took a series of readings on the glands from a philosophical and metaphysical standpoint. They discovered, among other things, the existence of a gland unknown to science, the Leiden, located above the gonads, and a point of entrance of the life force into the body. At least the reading said so. That was a catch. The results of the research were worthless outside the association. They had no credence with any but those who believed in the readings. This cry Hugh Lynn heard from doctors, professors, psychologists, and scientists. All your records are your own. They were not made under test conditions. Hugh Lynn realized that the records of most doctors, professors, psychologists, and scientists were also their own. But there was a difference. Psychic phenomena were suspect. A reading was taken to discover the best method of scientifically observing the phenomenon. The information said that if a student would come to the beach and watch the readings day by day, examine the mail, both incoming and outgoing, and check up with the patients and their physicians, the work would be proved. But the reading specified only to that one man. He cannot convince others. For what is wrong with the world today? Man has forgotten his God. So if you would prove anything, first so live that your life is an example, a testimony, that God is the God of truth, and the law is one. One day Hugh Lynn came out to visit Edgar, who was fishing from his pier on the lake. Hugh Lynn was carrying a large book, battered and obviously very old. Dad, this may help us with the scientists. This is a story of a man who lived in this country and did exactly the thing you do, less than 100 years ago. Edgar read its title, The Principles of Nature, Her Divine Revelations, and A Voice to Mankind, by and through Andrew Jackson Davis. The Poughkeepsie Seer and Clairvoyant. Andrew Davis was born in Blooming Grove, New York, in 1826. His family was poor, and his parents did not consider education a necessity for their son. His formal schooling was limited to 5 months. While Andrew was working as a shoemaker's assistant, a lecturer on mesmerism came to town. He demonstrated on various members of the audience, but failed to have any success with Andrew. After the lecturer left, several local men began experimenting with a phenomenon. One, a tailor named Livingston, had some success. When he tried his luck at magnetizing Andrew, his experiment was as successful as that of De Puysegur with Victor, the shepherd boy. Andrew fell into a deep trance and showed remarkable powers of clairvoyance. The boy was put to all sorts of tests, which he passed. But finally he said, while in a trance, that his powers were to be used to help the sick. Thereafter, Mr. Livingston took him about the countryside and built up a medical practice. Eventually, the pair met a Dr. Lyon and a Mr. Fishbow. Andrew announced that he was to begin a series of readings on the cosmos and the destiny of man, with Lyon as a conductor and Fishbow as the scribe. The readings were to be given in New York, 157 of them in all, given over a period of 14 months. In the same year, the results were published by Lyon and Fishbow. Edgar, reading the small type with Hugh Lynn peering over his shoulder, felt a shiver of recognition. What became of him? Hugh Lynn sat down beside his father. He continued to give readings for 35 years. Then he decided to study medicine. When he was 60 years old, he received his degree and began to practice. After he became a doctor, he made the usual inquiries about establishing a diagnosis, but he got most of his information by placing the tips of his fingers against the palm of the patient's hand. Apparently, the mechanism of his clairvoyance had changed. He no longer had to go to sleep to become sensitive. He was 84 when he died. This was his first book. He wrote many, many more. They're out of print, and Davis seems to have been forgotten except by a small group of enthusiasts. But I understand the group is growing. When we tell this to the scientists, they'll see that we're not alone. You have Andrew and Victor the shepherd boy, and hundreds of others whose cases have been recorded. Edgar shook his head. If you had this fellow and Victor the shepherd boy and me lined up in the same room, and we all gave readings on the same case and agreed, and a doctor, the scientist trusted, made a diagnosis of the sick man and said we were right, do you know what would happen? The scientist would still say that I was a fraud and a fake. He handed the book back to Hugh Lynn and went on with his fishing. Let Andrew and Victor and me rest in peace. As time passed, Hugh Lynn's files bulged with histories, parallel studies in psychic phenomena, and research readings given for study groups. Still, the scientific community showed no interest. Those who came to discuss, to argue, and to learn were those already convinced of clairvoyance. Some of these were psychologists by profession, and a few were psychiatrists, but all were careful to keep such private beliefs out of the professional theory and practice. Gradually, Hugh Lynn realized that the best evidence of the consistency of the readings lay in the records of the families whose members for many years used Edgar as a family doctor. Frank Moore's family was one of these. David Kahn's family was another. Perhaps the best family record was that of the Houses, Carrie, Dr. House, and Tommy. Another valuable source was the Daily Mail, consisting of letters reporting successful treatments. Through the 1930s, Edgar Cayce lived quietly. Each day he got up early and watched the sunrise and read the Bible. The morning mail arrived around 10, and when it was read, the first readings of the day was given. Afterward, Edgar worked at his typewriter, answering letters. After lunch, he returned to the typewriter, staying there until he finished his correspondence. When the afternoon reading was finished, he went out to fish, to work in the garden, or to spend a few hours at his carpenter's bench. In the evening, he read the paper, listened to the radio, and played cards with Gertrude. Each summer, Carrie came to visit, and usually Tommy and his family. Edgar's sisters, too, came, and friends from other parts of the country made a habit of spending summers at the beach. The squire died in 1937. He was buried in Hopkinsville beside his wife. After the funeral, Edgar went to the old farm for a visit and walked through the woods until he came to the bend in the creek by the willows. There he said a prayer for his parents. The association was growing steadily. Plans were drawn for a new wing on the house to contain a library and a set of offices. Construction was begun in 1940 and completed in 1941. When World War II came, both Edgar's sons served in the army. Both of them also married, and by the end of 1943, Edgar had two grandsons. In March 1943, the first edition of There Is a River appeared. The mail began to increase and the telephone rang constantly. With Hugh Lynn gone, Edgar had to take over the job of examining the letters and dictating answers to them. The pattern of his day changed drastically. He increased his readings to 4 to 6 a day instead of 2. His hobbies were forgotten, his garden neglected. From June 1943 to June 1944, 1,385 readings were given. By August 44, the strain was so great that Edgar collapsed. He rallied his strength to give a reading for himself. Its instructions were simple and to the point. He was to go away and rest. He went to the mountains of Virginia. Gertrude went with him. For a time, he seemed to improve. He wrote letters to friends. He was cheerful about the future and full of plans for the expansion of the association after the war. In September, he suffered a stroke. He came home in November. On the evening of January 3rd, 1945, he passed away. A few hours before, rousing from a sleep, he had said, "How much the world needs God today." He was buried in Hopkinsville in the family plot. After Edgar's death, the work of the association began in earnest. In the files at Virginia Beach are over 14,000 readings. No other psychic has left so long and so large a record of his powers. To adequately classify and judge the material, and to integrate and formulate the theory and metaphysic that underlie the structure of the phenomena will take a generation. The activities of the association have remained, in accordance with a plan adopted in 1931, unostentatious and unpublicized. The association has an average membership of between 500 and 600. There's a turnover of about half of these from year to year. The other half remains as a solid basis for the association's research work. There's a mailing list of several thousand people who are interested in anything that pertains to Edgar. Members of the association are drawn from all the Protestant churches, from the Roman, Greek, Syrian, and Armenian Catholic churches, from the ranks of Theosophy, Christian Science, Spiritualism, and from many of the Oriental religions. Acceptance of the readings, of course, implies acceptance of Christianity. Since the dominant note of all philosophical and moral disquisitions by the readings is the Christ pattern as the ideal of mankind. In the field of philosophy and metaphysics, there is a need for an extensive system of cross-indexing and checking to match what the readings have said against what has been said by theologians, heretics, and teachers of religion and morals in all countries and all times. The readings have been as democratic in this respect as in the field of medicine. Whenever the law of one has been taught, there truth has lived. A stern set of ethics has emerged from the readings. They insist on perfection as the goal of individual human lives. Every misstep must be retraced, every injury undone, and every injustice rectified. The art of living that is revealed by the readings attracts only those who are ready to measure up to the ideal path of existence. But it has one great danger. It offers to these same people the temptation of forming a new religious organization or a new philosophical system. The readings consistently warned against this. In the words of one reading, we can hear the legacy of Edgar Cayce. ye have an organization with a physical being, with a mental being, with a spiritual concept, and that which is not merely idealistic in keeping with God's precepts may be that which may grow and become as a living thing. Let each phase of the work present how not only mentally but spiritually there is a grounding in truth, as is set forth in the Christ consciousness as exemplified by Jesus. And then ye may be very sure that all those influences from the spiritual realm are one. For whether Christ himself is Jesus, or others be sent as an aid, depends upon whether ye hold that ideal that is one with the universal truth.
We hope you enjoyed this condensation of There is a River, the story of Edgar Cayce by Thomas Chagrew. It is part of the Harper's Edgar Cayce Library. Look for more quality audio cassettes and books at your bookstore.